Matt Bavala with you here, 720 WGN. Our friend Kim Bilware is in studio with us. She woke up a little late. I was just talking about Johnny because I was getting a little nervous. Because then you think, well, it is 3 a.m. So then you start getting worried about somebody. Because I texted you back and I was like, oh my God. Because then I'm worried. Did I make it sound like, don't worry about it, don't even come in?
No, no.
Because you did say, I'm like, oh. So I'm rereading that to Jess, like, I don't know. What do you think's happening? So I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming in.
Yes, always good to be here.
In the middle of the night, especially. So let's talk first about George Papadopoulos.
Yeah, that was an interesting story this week. So if everybody remembers, this time last week, everybody was, I think, as I said in a Chicago Magazine piece this week, either kind of anticipating or dreading, depending on your perspective.
Or just annoyed about this attention to this fake news that's coming out. There's also that. There's sort of a third, right?
Yeah, there's many options in this. But so last week on Friday, special counsel Robert Mueller had announced that, you know, the first wave of indictments was going to be coming out, and that was announced Monday. So there was the former Trump campaign, the one-time Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, his deputy Rick Gates. And then, you know, so we saw those two, and Paul Manafort, I think, was someone that everybody was really anticipating would be the first one to receive an indictment. But the bombshell was, on the same time, Mueller unsealed documents announcing that one member of the Trump campaign had already pled guilty. And this is our hometown guy, Papadopoulos. And the stunning thing about that is, when they unsealed all of his charging documents, what people saw is that Papadopoulos had already been he had already pled guilty earlier.
Like in July, right?
Well, he had been arrested in July. He'd pleaded guilty October 2nd. So this had been, you know,
and we didn't know any of that.
This.
Did we know he'd been arrested pled guilty?
There was none of that. And that's why it was sealed until now, because then, so really the stunning part about that is they already had a guilty, guilty plea from someone, and he had been arrested in July. And they said in the charging documents that he had had repeated conversations with, you know, the government, which is in this case Mueller's, special team of investigators. So what that told legal analysts is that Papadopoulos had been cooperating with the government since July. So all this time, Mueller's team has been asking him questions, and he's been cooperating. And, you know, I think I wrote that he was the first in the door, as they say.
Right.
So he got the best deal.
Right.
And now there is some talk that other staffers might be wanting to make deals, because obviously the further on it goes, the, you know, less attractive the deals are going to be, that the government's going to extend these, you know, these potential witnesses.
Well, so there's a couple of interesting questions that come out. One is, how much is there actually to know? How much meat is there on this bone, right? And then the other thing is, with Papadopoulos, how much does he actually know? Because it seems like a case of, right now, the Trump campaign, low level, had nothing to do with him. He's nothing. Back during the campaign, when they needed to say, we have all these great people, he's one of the people they're touting. He's going to be on the foreign policy team. He's this, he's that, right? And now it's, oh, he was nothing. He was not involved in anything. I think I would imagine possibly the same thing for Mueller. And as he starts trotting out, we've been talking to this guy since July, he's this and that. And you're saying other people might want to, you know, he's the first one in. But you wonder, does he really have a lot to offer? Does he really know a lot? We know he had some contact and stuff like that, but I don't know. I wonder, do you think there's really going to be, I wonder when this is all said and done, and either something really comes of it, or it ends up being sort of a lot of smoke and not enough fire, is Papadopoulos going to figure into it, or is he going to be just a footnote of, yeah, this was the first guy to plead guilty, but he didn't really have that much to offer?
I think he's going to be significant because, you know, when we look back to the campaign, Trump's campaign was really unconventional. And one of the things that, you know, his team said earlier this week was that Papadopoulos was, you know, he was this nothing guy. He was this volunteer. But technically, Paul Manafort was a volunteer, too, because he wasn't taking a salary. So some of these definitions of, you know, volunteer, low level, these are really subjective terms, and they don't always mean what people might think they mean. There was a lot of, you know, quote unquote, volunteers in the Trump campaign who were incredibly powerful and influential people, and were privy to a lot of meaty stuff.
But But Manafort, at least, was the campaign chairman. I mean, he did, right. volunteer or not, he had a big title. Papadopoulos, I think there's some question, too, was this guy inflating as it was how important he was?
Now, that's an interesting thing because, you know, when you dig into this guy a little bit, you know, he has some real resume padding going on, you know, that you saw. And
which we all understand, right? I mean, we all do that at some point in our life. And, you know, a 30-year-old who's, you know, how much experience is he going to have when it comes to this? The fact that he's on this at all should have raised red flags in the Trump campaign. Like, the dude's only 30. How much does he really know?
And everybody was surprised because, you know, foreign policy was considered probably the weakest part of, you know, Trump's knowledge base. And so when he was doing his interview with the Washington Post last year and they asked him who he had on his foreign policy team, you know, Trump was, you think back to where his campaign was in the middle of the summer, and it wasn't looking, you know, as strong as it did right. towards the end. And so all of the good foreign policy people, if you're, you know, a Republican presidential candidate, they were already working for somebody else.
Right.
And so he announces this, you know, team of five guys, including Papadopoulos, and everyone's like, who is this? I've never heard of him. Now, the interesting thing is that because there is a lot of unconventional ways this campaign was run, you do have people who were maybe not traditionally what you would think is someone who is as well connected. And you always kind of want to look at those background players. When I was talking to some people who are involved in some of the candidates for the Illinois gubernatorial campaign, two of the most interesting people I think to talk to would be the campaign photographer, because they go everywhere with the candidate, and the janitor. You know, people who, they're not high-level people, but they're always in the room. And I think that Papadopoulos could have been someone like that because, you know, he had access to the people, and he was, we even saw in, you know, photo evidence, he was at some of these meetings at the table with important people. And more than anything, even if he doesn't know what maybe went on in some of these really, really tight inner circle conversations, he can speak to the culture of the entire campaign. And that is why he could be valuable, because he can kind of verify things that documents alone wouldn't be able to.
So he'll help them understand a little more how the inner workings were, and maybe that'll help them with questions that they asked other people, things like that. It's going to be fascinating. With what we found out about Papadopoulos, do you think that, because it's some really interesting stuff came out this week, right? There's all of this about Russia, and, you know, a guest on Patty's show was saying earlier that he was upset with the media this week because the media, and it's funny, I was in Kansas City on Monday for business. And so I'm working on some stuff on Monday morning before I go to my meetings, and I've got the news on, and Fox News and MSNBC were right next to each other. And I thought it was perfectly balanced, because the only thing you were going to hear about on MSNBC was the indictments. And the only thing you would hear nothing about on Fox News seemed to be the indictments. So it balanced out in the end. But the guest on Patty's show was saying that he's upset with the media, that some of the media he feels is distorting collusion, that anytime somebody spoke with anybody in Russia, they're saying this is part of the collusion, when that's not necessarily illegal. There's certain ways that people might have been doing illegal things, but not every single thing that means somebody talks to somebody in Russia is collusion. With what Papadopoulos we read and have heard that he was part of, do you think there is anything illegal for the Trump campaign in his role, or do you think it's going to be more he was involved in stuff, they weren't saying no, they weren't, like, you know, reporting things right away as maybe they should have? Where do you think that's headed?
I think the part that could get Papadopoulos in trouble is the parts of the email that talked about somebody having dirt on Clinton.
Right.
And I think
which also happened with one of the Trump Jr., right? Where, hey, I love it if it's true. I mean, that came out months ago. So why is this a bigger deal than that? I would think that's more, my God, Trump Jr. is taking meetings with somebody saying from Russia, we have dirt on Hillary. And he's saying, hey, if you got that, that's awesome.
I think, and I'm not 100% sure of it, but I think the bigger problem for Papadopoulos in the campaign is it would show, you know, willingness to cooperate with, you know, everybody, people will commission, you know, Oppo research and things like that.
Right.
But the kind of the invitation to, you know, accept this kind of compromising information from a foreign government, I think, is what makes it problematic. You know, I'm not entirely clear on kind of the ethics of where you can get your opposition research from.
Yeah.
But I think that one might be a little bit above my pay grade. But
because that's the other thing that came out this week was the dossier, and that maybe it was last week, but it's blending together for me, that Hillary and the Democratic National Committee paid for a lot of the dossier. So that was a big hubbub when that came out. And everybody on the right's getting all up in arms at Crooked Hillary and look at what they did, look at what they did. And then a little more quietly than that, it also, I feel like part of that came out that the RNC actually started that research. At least this is what I read, that the Republican National Committee started that research and dropped it when Trump got the nomination.
Yeah, Trump's
so
own.
So they wanted to use it to prevent him from getting the nomination. When it didn't work out, they stopped. And those people probably said, well, let's call the other people and see if they want to continue this. And then the Democrats are cutting the check to say, let's find out what's going on. So there was a lot of very righteous indignation from both sides about this. But that is probably, from everything I've ever read, very commonplace that you're searching for dirt on your candidates wherever you can when you're the opposition. Isn't that standard?
I think maybe the hostile foreign government is the thing.
Is the problem.
Because the part of the Steele dossier was done by a former MI6 intelligence agent, you know, from the UK. So also a foreign government. But again, I think this one I'm not entirely certain of, but I think it's the willingness to accept, you know, damaging material about, you know, someone involving a hostile foreign government in, you know, in the campaign. And that is what could be the problem.
It's very interesting. And I know this isn't either yours or my expertise, but like if you're running a campaign and somebody comes and says, we have dirt on your candidate, I don't know of anyone that's going to say, no, we can't have that. Now, maybe they should have gone to the FBI right away and said, hey, we're getting this information, but you should be aware. But at the same time, and I don't want to make excuses, but the Trump campaign is not full of a bunch of seasoned veterans. You know, Donald Trump Jr. or Eric Trump have never run a campaign before. They, I guarantee you, don't know anything about the laws related to this. And they probably think everything's fair game because they've just ran this very nasty primary battle. And you know, it's, as we've seen in politics over the years, it's really been no holds barred, you know, with what things are being said about people and with Donald Trump tapes are being released and things like that. So they probably felt like, hey, anything we get, we're going to take. And whether it's legal or not, I wonder if they had even thought, well, if this is coming from a guy in Russia, is that legal? Can we do that? I bet they didn't even think about that. I mean, not that that's an excuse, but you could see where you don't have the people around you who've done this before. You're not running it by everything, probably by lawyers, because Donald Trump's used to just making decisions and running with it. I don't know. I'm just kind of like, I don't know if anything is ever going to come of any of this.
It could take a very long time. I mean, there's also that fear that the Mueller investigation is going to get shut down because, you know, that's something that Trump's been very interested in to try and just, you know, get him out the door. But he, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is he was appointed by Rod Rosenstein, who was the acting, head of the FBI at the time. And Mueller.
And everybody was really good about when he first was appointed, both sides were very positive about it.
Yeah. He had a lot of support from, you know, congressional Republicans, and now that he's really starting to turn over some stones, I think they're having some of them are having second thoughts. But I mean, I think I do think by and large, despite some of the commotion made today and yesterday by Republican lawmakers in Arizona and Texas and maybe Oklahoma, I can't remember all the states, who are saying we want to get this guy out of here. By and large, it still has the support of the Republican Party leadership. They are saying this should continue.
Well, and what do you read into that? Because it's very tough with President Trump to know, because a lot of these congressional leaders seem to talk out both sides of their mouth because they know that Donald Trump does not like criticism. So they have to be very careful because he is there. He is the guy. And if they want to get stuff done, he needs to be part of it. So it seems like the people that are retiring are pulling like a Twitter account and just like walking out the door and burning down the bridge. And they're fine with it because they're not running again. Flake and others.
Parker.
But if you're still going to be there, they're, you know, it's a very tough call for a Republican. Do we criticize Trump? Do we go after him here or do we not? And I wonder if with the Mueller investigation, if sometimes when they're criticizing it or saying he's not doing this, he's not doing that, if some of that is just to make the ultimate boss happy that he feels like people are on his side because he doesn't have the support that a president normally enjoys from his own party. All of his own doing, but he doesn't, it seems, at times have the support that he should have. I mean, they should have been able to get a lot of stuff done by this point. The major things he's wanted to do, tear apart Obamacare or, you know, as we go into this tax stuff, there have been things that have fallen flat because probably because he ticks off too many people in his party and can't rally them together.
Yeah, I think the people who are supporting getting rid of Mueller in Congress, and it's only three, maybe four of them. Those are the voices that are the very kind of diehard, Trump wing of Congress. And yeah. I don't think, I mean, there it'll be interesting to see what happens to the Republican Party as far as the kind of moderate and traditional Republicans, because there was a lot of talk too when Senator Jeff Flake said he wasn't going to run for re-election of, by 2018, what's the shape of the GOP going to look like? Is it going to be the people who share this more extreme worldview that a lot of people credit being crafted by, Steve Bannon and those and his ilk? Or are you going to have people who are a little more moderate? And I guess we'll find out.
Well, that is going to be really interesting, not just in that will Republicans lose seats in the House and the Senate. Historically, any president, right, after 2 years loses mm-hmm. some ground. Certainly Obama did. Certainly Bill Clinton did. I don't remember George W. where he was at. But generally, if you have control, you end up losing some control of the we tend to shy away from giving one party control for a long period of time. Right.
Midterms do also tend to favor Republicans.
They do. OK, so that's so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that and where they go, and also what type of Republicans will run. Will we see more Trump type Republicans run, or more more centrist Republicans run who would not have been pro-Trump, say, in the last primary? There's the people who are all for this nationalism and big tax cuts and all the things that President Trump really wants. And then there's McCain types who've kind of fought back against a lot of what he's done and believe that the party is changing in a bad way and want to go back to the old way of the party. What type of Republican candidates will be actually on the ballot when we get to the midterm elections?
Yeah, I mean, you saw with in the Alabama race with yes. Roy Moore and, Luther Strange. What a weird every single race in 2017 and onward seems to be what a weird, you can say what a weird race that was.
And Roy Moore, I mean, that's an interesting caricature of a person, right?
It's a very generous way of describing him.
Well, I mean, a guy that comes on stage, the hat and stuff like that, it's the South you expect, but carrying a gun and the things he's saying. I mean, this is the guy that said he believes there's Sharia law in Illinois.
And the guy who's been kicked off of the, kicked out of the court
yeah.
many times, off the bench.
Which people love because it yeah. means he stands his ground. He's not going to kowtow to what they want down there. And we're going to do it my way.
That pesky constitution.
Oh, it's going to be interesting. All right. Kim Bellware is in with us. We're going to talk a little bit more about national politics and George Papadopoulos. But also I want to chat about DNA Info and media in general, because HuffPost closed down here in Chicago. You used to work at DNA Info. You know a lot of the people and the players and just the state of media. I want to talk a little bit about where we're headed with that as well. Your calls, if you want them, 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. It's the Matt Bubala Show, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here in the historic Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. Kim Bellware is in studio with us. You can follow her on Twitter at Bellwack, BELLWAK. Right?
Yes.
At Bellwack. And she is a good follow on Twitter. You were mentioning off the air that you have a story on Rewire.com this week. Is that R-E-W-I-R-E?
Yes. Rewire.news.
Rewire.news. And that was a local story about keeping pregnant women out of jail, because that is an issue. I would have never guessed that in a million years, but that's an issue here in Cook County.
Well, it's an issue everywhere, and that's actually why I wrote the story, because there's not a lot of attention to, I think we end up talking about women in the criminal justice system a lot, because it's kind of one of my focuses,
yeah.
and because it's such a proportionally smaller share of the prison population, women don't get as much attention, pregnant women don't get as much attention, and when they do, it's for things like being shackled during birth and in state prison. But this is about women who are giving birth in county jails. So these are, you're in county jail either because you're serving a really, really, really small, kind of slap on the wrist sentence, or because you're waiting, awaiting your trial, in
right.
which case you are you are still presumed innocent. You haven't had your court date yet. And in Cook County, they had, 300 pregnant women. This is from the jail. They said last year there were 300 women in Cook County who were pregnant, and 17 gave birth. And recently, the, you know, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart and his team helped get some legislation together that just passed the Illinois State House this week, or no, it was last week. I'm sorry, it was last week, and it's expected to get the full, you know, the full support of the state Senate and be signed into law. It has a lot of bipartisan support, but it's really not only expensive, but also, you know, I think everybody agrees if you are not, even if you're guilty and you're in, you know, prison, that's just not a humane thing. This is not the kind of society we want to be, where women are forced to, you know, give birth in a prison or in a jail. And the legislation will actually not make a huge difference in Cook County, because it affects women who are too poor to bond out. Mm-hmm. So Cook County is enacting some cash bail reform right now. It's really going to impact other places in Illinois. And the whole problem with women giving birth in jail is especially problematic in rural areas, where the jail might be a lot further away from a hospital, things like that. They're not going to have as many resources. Cook County is the largest single site jail in the entire country. They have a dedicated medical wing. Even the sheriff agrees this is not a place for women to have babies,
yeah.
But they do, because they are so large and, you know, proportional to other, you know, tiny, small rural jails. They do have more resources and more staff, but in some places, I mean, you just don't have people equipped to deliver a baby there.
Well, I think a growing focus of the justice system, from what I understand, would be to help people not be coming back again and again and again, because that's bad for society. It's bad for the jail. It's bad for the budget. It's bad for everything. And you have to think that giving birth in jail is not the best way to start out your life with the child, because I imagine what happens if somebody's in jail and they can't post bond, their trial's coming up in 3 months, and they give birth. Do they keep the baby there in the Cook County Jail? I imagine they don't.
No.
Imagine that baby's got to go somewhere.
It either goes, you know, in some cases it might go with family members, but in a lot of cases that means, you know, a woman, you know, who hypothetically, you know, her charges might get dropped at the end of the day. She's not even guilty, and her child will spend the first months of its life in, you know, in the foster care system,
yeah.
Which is not, you know, an ideal outcome for taxpayers, for the baby, for the mom,
and yeah, yeah. Ugh. That's crazy. Well, it's good then that this legislation is getting through. I mean, this is a positive thing, right?
Yes, yes. And bipartisan support, which is something that we don't see a ton of these days.
We got to find our places. So at rewire.news, you can find that story by Kim. So you worked for HuffPost. They closed down their Chicago offices. Once upon a time, you did some freelance stuff, it sounds like, for DNA Info. There was another site called Chicagoist. That I wasn't as aware of. Joe Ricketts bought Chicagoist and the Gothamist sites back in April.
I'm not exactly sure.
Sometime this year.
Yeah, earlier this year.
And DNA Info, he had started in New York. It came to Chicago 2009, 2010, somewhere in there?
2012.
2012. Started in New York, I think, in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been around for almost a decade. And this week, he abruptly closes down all of those sites. And it was very abrupt to people. So I worked for DNA on a contract basis. I did this neighborhood news thing here for
right.
WGN. And I found out from John Williams, one of the hosts here, who texted me in the afternoon and said, "Hey, I heard DNA closed. Is that true?"
That's how.
So I went on the website and there it was.
And it's, I mean, that is how, we're laughing at it now. It's, you know, a little over 24 hours since.
Well, it wasn't my full-time job, so yeah. I can laugh about it. For others, it was incredibly devastating.
I mean, that is how. Most people, I mean, there was someone in New York who worked for DNA Info who worked for Gothamist. They literally found out that their job was gone and that their site was closed when they were coming back from the bathroom. I mean, other people found out about it from push alerts, from, you know, reading sites. Like if you were maybe out on assignment, you know, on DNA, or if you were with the Gothamist network, which
yeah.
was in, at its peak, it was at, I think, like almost 11 cities. But they had sites in Chicago, D.C., San Francisco, L.A., New York, you know, which was Gothamist, and maybe another one that I'm forgetting at. But, you know, if you were a contributor where you're not, you know, constantly in contact, you're not in an office
right.
with other people, you find out about that. And I mean, there are people who have been working on stories who have things, you know, in the hopper that are
oh, yeah.
ready to go up, and all of a sudden that just grinds to a halt. I mean, there was no warning. It was a complete shock to everybody. And the rollout of this, like, just you know, obviously people are now getting severance agreements and they're not going to be able to talk about everything, but it's there's no secret that this was done abruptly and very, very poorly, because you don't have to pull an entire site offline when you announce it's not going to continue publishing.
Yeah.
You know, you put your banner, like it's, you do what it looks like right now. You put a very prominent banner up that follows you around to every page. You don't make the whole thing, you know, and a decade worth of archival material completely inaccessible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and I think the problem people had with that is that almost, that's, it's a lack of transparency that almost borders on censorship. And it was seen, you know, whether this was a ham-handed way of, you know, managing or not managing the shutdown, a lot of people did see it as an intentional and very spiteful move by the DNA Info founder and CEO Joe Ricketts, because only last week the New York team voted to unionize with the Writers Guild of America East, which is the union that I'm also represented by. Like, and he's an anti-union guy. You know, he said in no uncertain terms that as long as it's my money, you know, I'm going to do what I want. And mm-hmm. he sees a union as interfering with that. And the other thing to, you know, kind of remember too is, you know, there's still all of the classic. I mean, look, I have my union card. I'm in a union. I'm pro-union.
Yeah.
So like I'm going to be upfront with that. I think that they're really necessary for especially digital journalists in the digital age where, you know, part of what the reason that HuffPost had this massive newsroom, you know, layoff earlier this summer was because the corporate parents were, you know, arranging new marriages, and we, you know, the newsroom has no control. So a union is a great way to protect yourself. And for people who, you know, aren't so sure about it, journalism's been kind of always a notoriously weird industry when it comes to unionizing. And a lot of it, I think, goes back to the kind of prejudice of union is a blue collar thing. Journalism is a white collar thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't need a union. We're professionals that we don't need to unionize. And of course, in Chicago, we're a union town. You know, there, you know, we do see that at, you know, places like the Trib and the Sun Times. But, you know, the thing with unions is when you are forming one, they can do whatever you want. They don't even have to address money. I mean, one of the big things for HuffPost when it unionized is it wanted a union to protect its editorial interests from its owner. I mean, increasingly you have Arianna Huffington, you know, she's no longer the editor-in-chief, but she's the, you know, she's the founder and she's the, you know, the owner of the site, and, you know, sold, you know, part of her interest to AOL, which was gobbled up by Verizon. But I mean, increasingly we see like the Washington Post is owned by Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, you know, the all sorts of properties. They're owned by billionaires who are not necessarily invested in the, you know, in the product of these news organizations, and they can be really meddlesome. I mean, I think Washington Post had some issues with having negative coverage of Bezos, you know, kind of scrubbed or otherwise objected to from high on. And that's something that a union would try and protect, you know, its reporters and editors against retaliation or just even having the powers that be descending down. When Ricketts bought the Gothamist Network, one of the first demands he made was that Gothamist and Chicagoist delete unfavorable stories that they'd written about him with regard to his previous political activities and the Chicago Cubs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, and that's a journalist.
Documented that he demanded
Tribune, that? Tribune, Gawker, other places or whatever Gawker was at the time, you know, wrote about those. And, you know, that's kind of like the journalistic no-no. Like you don't remove things from that have been published unless it's, you know, false defamatory,
that
kind of thing.
Well, that's interesting. I had never heard that. Now, I knew very little of Joe. I met him once or twice at DNA stuff, and I worked from the outside. From what I saw, he stayed out of the way of things. He wanted his overriding thing, and what I got from my boss, Seamus, was that you know, he wants non-opinionated news. He wants just news, not opinion. But for the most part, it seemed like he let them do their thing, and hopefully it was going to make money and things like that. And you know, it's interesting because a lot of people are posting this, like, well, the billionaire was upset about the union, so he shut it down. And people kept throwing out this billionaire who clearly can afford to spend this money, right? But at the same time, we have to think about, okay, I know he's a billionaire, But that doesn't mean he has to run this as a charity that he's going to lose money at forever, right? If he was losing money, which I assume he was, I don't think DNA Info ever turned a profit.
No.
Now, you had mentioned that you believe Gothamist and or maybe Chicagoist were turning a profit when they were sold to Joe Ricketts. And so who knows exactly what? Maybe the union thing was the last straw to him, or maybe he was looking at these losses for years and now they're unionizing. This is not going to get any easier to make money and pull the plug. I don't know why. Why he finally did it when he did. But I think it's very tough how people, and I don't mean to defend Joe Ricketts. Listen, I hate his politics. I was not a fan of his politics forever. But I felt like DNA was not forced to give a right-wing slant to anything. The stories and the reporters, they got great stories out. And I never heard about a lot of meddlesome interference from Joe Ricketts.
I mean, the only charitable thing I'll say about Joe Ricketts is, you know, from my friends, you know, and some close friends who were in management and who were reporters at DNA Info Chicago, I think that was the case. You know, he really did stay out of things. Also, you know, they cover hyper-local news. A lot of his activities were nationally
right.
relevant.
Right.
So it was kind of, they were in their own separate lanes anyway. Yeah. As far as him being a billionaire, yeah, I mean, that's an argument that's always going to come up. I think that's fair. You know, it's his money. He's not running a charity. I think you can make another argument for, you know, what is the responsibility when you do have all of this news that is, you know, it is the public record. I mean, he paid for it and other people produced it, but it kind of transforms. It becomes, I think, you know, part of the public trust at that point. And he operated DNA Info, at least DNA Info Chicago. It never was profitable. That's pretty widely known. But he was happy to operate it at a loss this entire time. And it's only after the union, you know, the unionization, if he was unhappy losing money on it, I mean, it's very suspicious to me that once the unionization comes, he says this is no longer financially tenable. I mean, it never was financially tenable. So it's funny to make that argument now. And the other thing is the union hadn't even made any demands yet. So it's you know, possible that none of the union's demands would have even been financial. It could have been all about editorial control.
And it is also possible that the union thing wasn't really the driving factor because, like you said, they hadn't made any demands yet. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he knew this was going to cost us all this insane money. But I will say, like you said, oh, he's been happy to lose money for all this time. Well, I doubt he was happy to lose money for all that time. He put up with losing money for all that time. But I will say at DNA Info, there were cutbacks last year.
Yeah, there were big cutbacks.
There were huge cutbacks. So like I had like more of a full-time job there doing the radio things. That got completely cut out. I was only doing the neighborhood news and a bunch of freelancers got completely cut out.
Yeah. They cut a lot of
so he had already had, and you know, and basically was said at the time was it's been losing money for this amount of time. He's only willing to do so much of that. And so this was somewhat, I mean, it's not like spend money. Holy crap. Union. We're all done. You know, there were some signs of there's some issues here and he's unwilling to lose this amount of money.
Yeah.
At least for, you know, almost 12 months ago that
came
through. Yeah,
you know, that was true. There were big budget cuts last year. I mean, it's still hard for me to see the shutdown as anything other than union busting, though, because, you know, his COO said as much. I mean, this is classic union busting talk saying, if you do this, you know, you're going to endanger the, you know, financial. I have a problem. Like I said, you know, they didn't even make any financial demands necessarily. Who knows if they would have? I guess we'll never know. But the other thing is, you know, he shut it down so abruptly. And you have these professionals who have spent, in Chicago's case, 5 years, in New York's case, you know, more than that, of their lives invested in this, you know, in this job, in this community, that both the community they've built with the neighborhoods they cover and the community, you know, that workplace. And nobody should lose their job like that. Nobody should find out that they lost their job through a, you know, a tweet or a push alert or by going to their own website and seeing that it's dark. I mean, there was no warning at all. And as we've seen with Patch, another hyperlocal news site that was previously owned by AOL, you can, there is money in these things. There might not be a lot of money, but we've seen lots of media properties. We've seen the carcasses, you know, picked clean and sold over and over until they're pretty much zombies of their former selves. I mean, the brands of Gothamist and their affiliate sites and DNA Info would have been valuable to someone for something. So, you know, he could have.
So you think it was spiteful? He could have maybe tried to get the Tribune Company or somebody to pony up at least a little bit of money.
He could have cut,
take these over.
And Patch did. I mean, Patch is a shell of its former self. The kind of cutbacks that it's had, it has been cut back to the point of profitability. It also doesn't resemble anything of what it used to, and it doesn't do the coverage that it used to. But you know, if he wanted to make some money back, like there was something, there was money, if money was, I'm tired of, you know, throwing money out the window on this, he could have got some of that back. So I find
that. So you think it was a bit spiteful? Just, I think it was spiteful. I'm shutting this down and that's it.
Yeah.
That's fair. I mean, yeah, it's maybe we'll never truly know. I mean, to me, he shuts it down and puts that thing up because he is maybe very self-important. And it's
total
my site and I'm going to tell, I want to tell the world my story and da 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 da. Because I fully believe that he never was blast, you know, everybody was all up in arms that the archives are gone and oh my God, all my work. And I understand that, but I never felt like, wow, he wiped this out and he's never going to let these people have that. You know, the archives came back the next day. It was his kind of, maybe that was his power play of taking away for a day and scaring everybody. Look what you did with this union. I don't know. I could see it more being just ego. Like it's a note from me, sort of like, you know, somebody else who would tweet something very important to the world because they have to hear what I have to say.
Who does that?
He wanted to throw that out there. So who knows? But it is sad to see it go. But, you know, I was thinking today, Heidi Stevens wrote a wonderful article in the Tribune about the reporters and how important they are and things like that. And it got me thinking, and I meant to do this today, and of course I didn't, and that's the problem in society, is that...
Matt forgetting things?
Well, that we don't pay for a damn thing anymore. We pay for way too much. And it's funny how we get sucked into... We've all just accepted the fact that we're going to pay tolls to travel around on what should be the free roads of America for the rest of our lives, to the point that we're not even going to pull the change out anymore. We're just going to hand somebody our credit card and let them keep dinging us for $20 every time it gets low. And we don't even think about that. And I pay like $270 to Comcast every month for channels and internet and phone. And I do all these things, but we refuse to pay for journalism. Now, I still subscribe to the Chicago Tribune and we get home delivery. And I will tell you, what you pay for that now is ludicrous. Because 20 years ago, I paid half the price and probably got twice the content.
Yeah.
It's amazing how thin the paper is now. And that's just the world we're in, right? Everything moved to digital. It doesn't work the same way anymore. But we still pay for that. And I refuse to stop paying for that because I believe it's important. Although it kills me every time I see how much we're paying for it. I'm like, oh my God, are you serious? It's insane what home delivery costs anymore. But when I get to my 9 articles a month at the New York Times, I get, oh, damn, I'm out of free articles. Same thing with the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And I think what we all need to do is start committing ourselves to paying for some of what we get for free. Now, it's the media's own fault because the newspaper industry was very wealthy when the internet was first coming out. And the newspaper industry historically has been a huge embracer of new technology, whether that was going to be to the benefit or not. Tribune Company started WGN Radio in 1924, and that was a way of giving away the content for free, and maybe that was going to hurt the newspaper. Same thing with television. Mm-hmm. They started TV, and all these newspapers started TV stations. All these newspaper magnates became radio and TV, and they really embraced all these things, and they had a lot of money to do so. But when the internet came out, and we started putting the Chicago Tribune online, and all the stories are there, and I think all of those companies really started giving away content like crazy, and then realizing this is not so good for us and have never figured out a good way to get people comfortable with paying for it. Now we go to Yahoo, we go to these other sites and we figure out ways to see the articles basically for free. And the ad revenue will never make up for what you used to get in the newspapers. It's just never going to happen.
Well, the Mike, for sure, I always say his name wrong. Mike, if you're listening at some point, I apologize. He is the publisher of The Daily Line. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it focuses on, it's daily news reporting and, they do a lot of city hall politics. They really zero in on a couple really wonky things, like I think bond rate, you know, kind of like bond discussion, you know, bond ratings and things like that. And he says that their readership is really, really dedicated. in a lot of cases, more knowledgeable than the reporters, who are all excellent. But I mean, this is deep stuff. And
right.
So, but they have a captive audience. And he previously did the hyperlocal news thing. He was the publisher of Edgeville Buzz and Center Square Journal, which was up in Lincoln Square, which I think that folded around maybe 2006, you know, seven around there. And he wrote on his personal blog, I think today, something about how, you know, he wasn't really, I don't know, he didn't get into his own feelings about, you know, DNA in Chicagoists, but his feeling was the model was never going to work to begin with. And he said, I've done this. I've tried it. There's no money there because the entire model of trying to take the print model that had been in, you know, at work for more than a century and then trying to digitize it was never going to work because digital rates and print rates were, right. you know, there was no comparison. And now you have, you continue to have these, you know, disruptive players like Google Ads and Facebook Ads. I mean, everybody's going to Facebook Ads because it's so much more targeted. You can be sure that your money is landing with the right,
right.
audience. So, you know, who's going to put a banner ad on a news site now? And so with the Daily Line, they have expanded. You know, they were stable. They've expanded. I think my understanding, it's a pretty small staff, but everybody gets paid well. Everybody, you know, everybody gets paid, which is not
right.
the case for Gothamist contributors, at least until recently.
But is that a very niche news site? What they're
it is niche, but I mean they do cover things. I mean, I think they're a lot more, I mean, they're a lot more businessy. They don't have kind of like the voiciness that,
right.
you know, DNA and Gothamist Chicago sites, you know, would show. But people pay a subscription. I think it's $40 a month and it's almost $400 a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, people will balk at it. But when you also think about if you are someone who does business or who cares about things like what happens in bond rating meetings, you're not going to go to those. You can't go to all of those.
Yeah.
You pay for someone. And I was talking with, you know, Patty Wetley, who is the Lincoln Square reporter for DNA Info
yeah.
Tonight, you know, great reporter. And, you know, I did see a lot of solidarity from national journalists who, when they came to Chicago on assignment and they were pursuing their own kind of like wonky story, they always bumped into a DNA Info reporter.
Yeah.
If they go to bond court, the only people who aren't family was a DNA reporter.
Yeah.
I mean, and for things we do lose sight of, I mean, as journalists, I don't know if it's our responsibility or if it's our, you know, manager's responsibility, you know, whose it is, but there hasn't been a very good job done really conveying to the public, I think, just how important, you know, what they're getting, because nobody wants to go to an LSC meeting, to a CAPS community policing meeting, you know, to ward night, to, you know, water reclamation district meetings.
Yeah.
But these are where the decisions get made that tell us whether or not we're going to have a big, ugly new building across the street from us, or whether this is going to get zoned for new business, or whether
yeah.
money is going to go here, whether we're going to pay this much for water. Nobody wants to go to those meetings. So that's why you pay for news, because you have an experienced, skilled journalist who will go to those meetings for you and then write, you know, write up the important stuff. But the other thing I want to, you know, kind of point out too, is people say, you know, nobody's going to pay for news and, you know, this and that. I think what is interesting is the poor beleaguered millennial generation who is killing everything. You know, millennials are killing this. Millennials are killing that.
Yeah.
They're killing the doorbell. They're killing news. You know, one thing that millennials are paying for is content. I am on the older end of the millennial range. but I mean, I pay for Spotify. I pay for Netflix. I pay for Hulu. And I also pay for my news subscriptions. But, you know, you think when you're talking about people paying for cable, people paying for, you know, tolls and things like that, think of how many subscribers Netflix has. That's, you're watching television. People used to watch it for free.
They did. And it's interesting, but Netflix came out saying, okay, if you want this, we're going to charge you for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they established that from the beginning. The problem, I would agree, is not the millennials. You guys are used to, we're charging, we're automatically doing all these things. And I'm used to it because the tollway made us do it from the beginning. And cable made us do that. If you wanted it, you had to do this. Newspapers gave it away for free at first. That's the problem. And we can still get so much of it for free, right? And it's, I would agree, the older generation who's like, why would I pay for that? I'm not used to paying for that. I get that for free. Maybe we're still subscribing to newspapers. Maybe we're not. But that's probably what's killing it more than anything is the older generations that have just are getting the, oh, my God, it's all right there on my computer. Why should I? Especially because the newspaper industry also let the rates go through the roof. Home delivery used to be very affordable. Mm-hmm. It's like going to college 30 years ago versus now. Everything went through the roof and you feel like you're getting less for it. And now, and the other problem I really feel is that by not subscribing to newspapers, and this is not just the digital subscription, which we all need to start paying for, but when you get a newspaper and you actually take the time to look at it, you're going to read stories you never would have clicked on or they Absolutely. Never would have shown to you because they know what the hell you want. I invest in Apple Computer and I love Star Wars. You know when I go to Yahoo, how many damn Star Wars and Apple Computer stories there are every single day?
Yeah.
Not because they're in the news, because they know I click on that crap. So I'm missing all these other stories. And I was saying earlier tonight, that's why I love Twitter so much, because I follow people like you and all these other journalists from around the country and the BBC, and I see stories that I never would see if I didn't like you on Twitter, like the death penalty stories and the ways I've gotten to know you, because you have those stories out there. Other than, you know, that's not going to show up in my Yahoo news feed because I haven't
the
normally
curation,
clicked on
yeah,
that.
That's, yeah, I think that's a huge, hugely important point about, you know, the level to which media has fragmented. I mean, this was something you learn in Communications 101 when I was in college, of back when there were just, you know, three networks. There yeah. was a lot of kind of shared, you know, it was a shared experience watching the news and watching television programs. It is cool that people who are into, you know, like all female over 6 foot tall fly fishing have their own, you know, dedicated channel. And
yes.
Things can be as specific as you want them to be or, you know, whatever. But yeah, that's kind of the downside of it is you don't get the full breadth of things. And with the, reading, you know, kind of reading the full papers, I served jury duty this summer, earlier this summer in Cook County. And one of the things they asked, because I made it all the way to the end, was there the mm-hmm. whole day. Why would you have a criminal justice reporter on a murder trial? Right. They're never going to pick me. But
right.
They kept me to the very end. And they asked what kind of, you know, they asked what news you read, what sites you read, what, you know, what kind of things you looked at. And juries are, to me, the great cross-section of America. I mean, you truly have every type yeah. of person there because it's just random of, like, everybody who lives in this county. And the responses, you know, you had because people are just telling – I mean, they ask you the question. So
yeah.
you know what people do for a living, if they went to college. Typically, college-educated people did tend to read more by their responses, you know, anecdotally in this jury pool. They tend – to read more and to subscribe to more things. You know, a lot of them read, you know, New York Times, NPR, yeah. Washington Post. I don't even want to say that younger people read less news, but there was definitely like a digital component that was emerging where there was a lot of people, I would say a solid quarter to a third of the people in the jury that responded did not read any news outside of like what their Apple News app showed them.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, that shows a stunning lack of curiosity, and I would not want them in my jury. But you
well,
know.
It does. I mean, there is more news available to us than ever before from good sources and from sketchy sources.
Yeah.
But there's more out there than ever before. And we're getting narrower and narrower in our focus of what we're willing to listen to. Kim Bellware, thank you so much for coming in. We're out of time as the buzzer went off a while ago. Follow her on Twitter at Bellwack, B-E-L-L-W-A-K. Read the story she did about pregnancies in the Cook County Jail at rewire.news. Read about Papadopoulos, the story she did there at chicagomagazine.com. Right? Chicagomag.com?
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming in.